is a long time ago, and they would have never been able to carry on with this war more than 2 to 3 months. And that's when the Americans came to the rescue. So they can't play innocent now.
And that's a good point, Doctor. And I'd like to put that same question, if I could, to our Press TV colleague here in our Tehran studios, Kiarash Pur Nemati. Kiarash, how do you see, you heard with Dr. Barut's take on this, how do you see the relationship and how it impacts things on the ground, especially in West Asia, between U.S., the Joe Biden administration and that of Benjamin Netanyahu and his cabinet? We hear a lot of rhetoric that there are serious friction between the two. Is it for public consumption, Kiarash, or are there serious divides there? And if so, why do we still see the influx of weapons into the regime where the U.S. has so many tools it could employ to curb Israel's adventurism and its violence in the region?
Well, thank you for having me. I believe that the Democratic Party might need a ceasefire up until the election time, because they might need to use it for the for getting more votes from the people that they will vote for them because of the ceasefire. As you can see, what is happening in the United States of America will show that to you as well. But I believe that Netanyahu and Trump are doing something else here. I believe that there is this ongoing thing between them that they want to, I believe Netanyahu wants to do something before the October and the elections of the United States of America, so Trump will be more likely to win, because as it was shown in his last period, Trump gave a lot more money, a lot more support to the Israeli lobby. And you could also see the Israeli lobby playing a hand here. I believe that the previous president in the United States of America, who called the the Israelis and told them to stop in what was happening in Lebanon, was Ronald Reagan. And ever since then, I'm pretty sure that the Israelis made whatever it took so they will never get the same phone call from any U.S. president ever again. And this is what we are seeing right now. As genocide is taking place, thousands, hundreds of thousands of people are affected by it across the region, and Joe Biden cannot stop this. But we all know that the genocide in Gaza cannot continue without U.S. support, without the Western support, but they don't, so that is right.
And for our viewers that are just joining us, in a very much anticipated response to Israeli regional aggression, Iran has attacked Tel Aviv with what we're hearing, hundreds of ballistic missiles, including hypersonic missiles there at mostly the area of and around Tel Aviv in occupied Palestine. According to the IRGC, only about 10% of the missiles were intercepted. Earlier, we saw Iran's UN mission with this statement saying Iran's legal, rational, and legitimate response to the terrorist acts of the Zionist regime, which involve targeting Iranian nationals and interests and infringing upon the national sovereignty of the Islamic Republic of Iran, has been duly carried out. And it says, should the Zionist regime dare to respond or commit further that's acts of violence, a subsequent and crushing response will ensue. It said regional states and Zionist supporters are advised to part ways with the regime. Iran has vowed for quite some time, since actually July 31st, that it will give a response to Israel for its adventurism, and at that time for the targeting of Ismail Haniyeh, the Hamas political bureau chief, who was martyred by the Israeli regime in the Iranian capital, Tehran, upon the day after the inauguration, or the night of the inauguration of the Iranian president, Masoud Pezeshkian. He was a guest of the Islamic Republic, and he was killed on Iranian soil that day. And just last Friday, on the 27th of September, in a Beirut southern suburb, an attack by the regime leveling multiple structures there, including Hezbollah headquarters, that culminated in the martyrdom of the Hezbollah Secretary General Saeed Hassan Nasrallah, along with his guest, IRGC Brigadier General Abbas Nil Furushan. They're both martyred in that attack, possibly pushing the government in Tehran to give up its so-called strategic patience and carry out this attack against the Zionist entity that we saw Tuesday night around 8 p.m. local time, involving, as we just said, hundreds of ballistic missiles. Now, the barrage was also accompanied, according to Iranian officials, by a large-scale cyber attack, and they also say that they utilized Iran's new Fatah hypersonic ballistic missiles for a first time. How many of these hundreds of missiles were of the hypersonic nature, we do not at this point know, but this is a quickly developing story, and I'm sure throughout the next day or two, we're going to get much more in with respect to the exact weapons used. And we hear at this point that IRGC says that there are three Israeli military sites that were targeted, including the one that the assassination of the Hezbollah leader was basically carried out from. Also among the targets supposedly was a Mossad, one of the Mossad centers or possibly Mossad headquarters in Tel Aviv. Now, the Israeli military said it reported about 180 missiles targeting Tel Aviv, and that it said a large number were intercepted. But images and eyewitnesses, and there are images all over social media and in also newspace, that will refute that claim, as you will see dozens upon dozens of those missiles hitting targets on the ground in Tel Aviv over the night sky there of the occupied Palestinian city. Now, the Iranian leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, earlier on X, formerly known as Twitter, said the righteous people may have to make some sacrifices, but they will not be defeated at the end of the day, that they are the victors in the field. He said this as a video was launched showing images of the initial missiles being launched from Iran. And now joining us is Dr. Ramzi Baroud, author and journalist out of Seattle, Washington. And also we have Kiarash Purnemati, our Presby colleague, joining us in our Tehran studios. Dr. Baroud, the region, with all its escalatory attacks as of late, and we mentioned, and you also mentioned, it's a failure to accept any kind of ceasefire that would have put an end to hostilities. It would have got its captives back. Benjamin Netanyahu said it's imperative for those 60,000 settlers to go back to areas along the southern Lebanese border. And that could have all been handled, and it could have all been resolved with the Gaza ceasefire. But the regime has chosen escalation. My question to you now, to what end? How far is the regime trying to push? Is it trying to push for all-out regional war in the region? And if it is, what is its end game there with that objective?
Thank you. So it all depends on how Israel defined these wars in the first place. I think this kind of lofty kind of strategic objectives, total victory, destroying Hamas, you know, making Palestinians less extremist, I think all of these nonsensical goals were designed to serve no particular purpose aside from giving Netanyahu the space and the time to do whatever that is truly on his mind. Now, how did Israel define what actually happened? Let's remember what Moshe Feiglin, the top Likud member and an old ally of Netanyahu, has said, I would say, about 2-3 days after October 7. What did he say on TV? He said, what worries me the most is that the Muslims, not the Arabs, not even the Palestinians or the Gazans, but rather the Muslims, are not afraid of us anymore. This means that the Israelis, and of course this statement was repeated in different ways and different forms by many others, they feel that something has shifted in the collective psyche of both the Palestinians and their supporters in the region and the Israelis. The Israelis are afraid, many of them are leaving the country, and the Palestinians are feeling empowered. And by extension, there is this sense of empowerment that's happening all the way from Yemen to Lebanon to Tehran, to Iraq, and of course to Palestine itself, and even beyond that, the global solidarity movement and all of that. So the true goal of Netanyahu, he is trying to reverse what the Palestinians have gained in the last year through their resistance and all of that. He wants to remind them that, no, the Israeli military has no particular limits and is still able to achieve political outcomes using the superior military technology. And number three, he's trying to kind of take advantage of the situation by saying, well, I am going to turn this against you. You thought that you won a certain battle. Fine, you did. But I am going to conclude the war in the way that I see right. And that is the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. In fact, the process of ethnically cleansing Palestinians from the northern West Bank to the south was an early or a first step towards the ethnic cleansing of all Palestinians to the Sinai Desert. Then the ethnic cleansing of many Palestinians from the West Bank elsewhere. Then the expansion of the Israeli border to the Litani River, and maybe even beyond that. I'm not buying into this Litani River because a single Hezbollah Katyusha, Lebanese resistance Katyusha, is able to cross 150 and 200 kilometers, or rather 20, 25 kilometers. It's going to the Litani River is not going to resolve Israel's supposed security problems. So Netanyahu has been trying to turn this into the kind of war that is going to reverse his country's misfortunes, turn them into an opportunity, as said by several Israeli top politicians, saying that this is going to be another Nakba, meaning ethnically cleansing the Palestinians. But he couldn't do that. He got stuck in Gaza for a whole year, and he still cannot do that. To the contrary, today, as the Iranian missiles were falling on Israel, some Palestinian families were actually rushing through the Netzarim area, which is where the Israelis are in central Gaza, trying to get back to their homes in northern Gaza. Israel killed 8 of them and wounded many more in the process. But they are desperate to go to the north. They are not in any mood of leaving to the Sinai Desert or to any other desert anywhere. So Israel's overall strategic objectives of ethnically cleansing the Palestinians have failed. So he goes to Lebanon, trying to find some kind of a victory here. And once again, by humbling Hezbollah, he feels that he's going to de-link them from Hamas, and therefore humbling the resistance in Gaza as well, and enforcing his own conditions. He's failing to do so in Lebanon. And what happened today by Iran is a reminder that you can't even de-link Hezbollah from Hamas. How are you going to, you know, de-link Iran from the rest of these movements, whether in Yemen, in Lebanon, in Gaza? So this is a huge problem. What happened today is sending those Israeli leaders back to the drawing board, trying to figure out what went wrong and what could possibly their next step be. But honestly, I think they are truly running out of options. And I think the language of today may indicate that Israel might be in the process of realizing that they climbed way too high on that tree, and that now it's time to come down.
Interesting take. I'd like to put that same one to you, Kirash. If you could, why do you feel the Israelis have chosen, Kirash, the path of more death and more destruction and more escalation at every juncture, where it was before them the opportunity of some kind of narrow roadway to peace and a possible restoration of calm to the region?
Well, I believe there are different reasons for it. One of the most important reasons for that one is what happened to the Israeli side on October the 7th. 1 year ago, Israelis were slapped so hard that they still cannot figure out how to get their heads around what happened. They failed militarily, they failed in terms of security, and that was a very big failure for them. So they are still trying to balance what happened, and they are failing in all the other terms. So I believe that what they are adopting is like a madman principle. But I will attack anyone that I can see. I'm really mad at whoever comes in my way. And, you know, for the previous weeks, they have been throwing a lot of stones. But I believe the Iranian side reminded them that they live in a glass house. And I believe that it was a very good movement from the Iranian side to balance the threats made by the Israelis against them. Now, to show why Israelis, you know, are failing at the campaign, as I just said a moment ago, they tried very much to eliminate Hamas. They failed. They tried to stop the Hamas side, the resistance, to stop the rockets firing at them. They again failed. They, you know, escalated the war between them and Hezbollah, the Lebanese side. They failed again, and they are still failing at what is happening between them and the whole resistance. So that is why they are adopting the, as I call it, the madman principle.
And Dr. Baroud, how close do you feel to what you mentioned earlier? Is the regime to achieving those objectives you mentioned, the rolling back of Palestinian gains, the delinking of strong relationships between its regional adversaries? If your point, and to your point that you said the regime is running out of options at this point, how do you suppose the Zionists will deal with that state of desperation? Because it could be very dangerous, not just for its neighbors, but for the region, as you, and for the world, for that matter. So how do you feel they will deal with this present dilemma, and how do you propose the region should deal with the regime from here on out?
What will the Israelis do? I think the guest in your studio is right when he described Netanyahu as a madman. But at the same time, this madman is also very clever. Like, he's mad but clever, very relentless. He will not give up. He will not reach a point in which he thinks, you know what, I overplayed my hands, and at this point I don't think I can possibly achieve anything, therefore I have to find to sign a peace or rather a ceasefire agreement with Hamas and get my prisoners back and end the war at all fronts. Because in his mind, I mean, Netanyahu thinks he's a prophet, not only the greatest leader in the history, not only of Israel, as Thomas Friedman put it, approvingly so, but as the history of the Jewish people. But there's more to it. Many in Israel do actually look at Netanyahu as if he's some sort of a prophet. He is the man who has led Israel from the state of being unable to create its own military technology to being one of the top 10 exporters of security technology to the rest of the world. He is the one who reestablished deterrence. He is the one who has done all of these things. Can you imagine a scenario in which Netanyahu is going to be leaving, you know, kind of dangling his head being kicked by everybody, you know, shamed by everybody, disgraced by everybody? So he is going to continue doing whatever he thinks he needs to do to protect his legacy within the overall history of Israel. But there are circumstances that are even beyond Netanyahu's ability to manipulate and to control. And one of them, and we cannot look down at this, what is happening in Israel. I mean, there was a point in which there was a crisis within social crisis in Israel, the kind of division where the hundreds of thousands of protesters throughout Tel Aviv and elsewhere really kind of reached a point where Netanyahu was almost dislodged. This is why he went to Lebanon. He went to Lebanon to escape his own crisis. And he succeeded. 70% of the Israelis support the invasion of Lebanon or the war on Lebanon. So now, after what happened tonight, how will the Israelis react to this? Who's going to jump ship first? Will he end up being disowned once more by those who support him? So this is a very, very important factor, and we need to look into it. The most important factor, in my opinion, is what we call in Arabic, in Palestinian resistance culture, we call it sumud, steadfastness. If we remain strong and steadfast, no matter how many stones Netanyahu throws at the Palestinians and the various Arab and Muslim resistance from Iran to Lebanon and elsewhere, he will never be able to achieve his objective. So resistance is absolutely critical. Post-war, I think it is time that we heal our collective wounds in this region, find our points of unity, stop dwelling on our divisions and our petty differences, find a way to normalize, not with Israel, but to normalize amongst ourselves as the original people, the owners of this land, the historic rooted civilizations of this region in the East Mediterranean, in, you know, and that includes everybody. We belong to this earth, we belong to this land, and we need to find a way to make it work for the sake of future generations of Muslims and Arabs, Iranians and Arabs in this region. It is essential that we do so. Otherwise, we are going to continue to be vulnerable to American and Israeli schemings of divisions, of strife, of so-called normalization, and that sort of thing.
Right. I'd like to also mention we have Mr. Paul LaRudy joining us out of Berkeley, California, from the Free Palestine Movement, to our rolling coverage here. Paul, pleasure to have you on. Your initial thoughts, Paul, with respect to Iran's retaliatory missile operation last night targeting Tel Aviv.
Well, this is unavoidable. Iran did its duty, and Iran did what it was. It had really very little choice but to do this. It could not allow Israel or even the United States to act with impunity. So at some point, Iran was going to have to defend itself and the region, basically. If it has allies, it has to defend its allies, and its allies have to defend Iran. So there was no choice in this matter. It was sooner or later. And some people think maybe Iran was too patient. And I understand the president saying that possibly he may have taken more time than he preferred because of the deception that was placed on him by the United States. So all of these things are factors that meant that this had to happen. But let's face it, let's look at the reality. Israel is actually, although it has all the weapons it can possibly use, it is still very weak. Why did Israel strike against Lebanon and Hezbollah, and why has it struck against Iran in the past? It's because it's getting nowhere. Netanyahu is getting nowhere with its struggle against Hamas, and Hamas is not a superpower, although it's behaving like one in some respects. So if it can't make progress in Gaza and against the Palestinians, then Netanyahu is going to look like a fool if he doesn't do something. And so he decided that he's going to do something so that people can say he's doing something. Well, he's done something, but so what? He's killed a lot of people. He's a murderer. He's proved that he's a murderer. But has he gained anything? I don't see what he has gained. And now Iran has made sure that they're going to pile loss upon loss on Israel in order to... because it's piled on top of the losses that it's facing with Hamas as well. So this is all what's going on. Israel is in a slow course of losing its own existence, and this is one stage on that route.
And Dr. Thank you, Paul. And Dr. Ramzi Baroud, many feel Iran also, perhaps to Paul's point, when we mention the patience and prolonging this retaliatory operation, many feel Tehran may have done this, and I'm not saying this because I'm in the know, I really don't know, but many feel that perhaps it didn't want to play into Israel's playbook. We know Netanyahu from the time he was in the Knesset 30 years ago until for the two decades that he's basically been at the helm, he's been pushing for war between the U.S., trying to instigate a war involving U.S. forces and the Iranians. And that's something, a luxury that no one in the region wanted to give the Zionist entity. But do you feel in that respect, if it does, it is successful in pushing for regional escalation, that it will actually be successful in achieving that objective, Dr. Baroud?
Israel has its own interpretation of what is happening, and it sees its war in Gaza and beyond as an existential war. Fine. But the axis of resistance, too, see this as an existential war as well. I mean, let's try to imagine the scenario of the defeat of Palestinians in Gaza and in the West Bank as well, like northern West Bank. There's a war going on there as well. Let's imagine a scenario in which Hezbollah is being pushed to behave according to the Israeli diktats. And they say, you know what, we are willing to stop this escalation in Lebanon with or without a ceasefire in Gaza. Imagine the breakdown of the moral fiber that unify these various groups. And imagine what would happen to Iran's reputation in the region. I mean, let's think, I mean, from a practical point of view, Iran is a regional superpower. And that superpower is responsible towards its allies and its the various units that work together to achieve certain policies. Their policies, in my opinion, are far more moralistic and ethically founded than the policies of an imperialist colonial settler colonial regime like that of Israel and its Western supporters. But for Iran, this is a consequential war. It's not the matter of, okay, fine, we are deterred. You are deterred. The entire apparatus of resistance is going to, you know, come down and it's just going to break up. And that is just going to be a disaster for the Middle East, because Israel will be unhinged. Israel is already unhinged, but imagine if there are no one fighting back against Israeli stratagem and Israeli designs in the region. So there is a certain point where Iran has made a decision that the harm of not responding is actually greater than the harm of responding. And I think that they chose a particularly thunderous response, as to say, let this be the response that ends everything now, because anything beyond this is an all-out war. So I think the Iranian was studied very, very carefully. It was intended to send a strong message. It was intended to think it did. Will the Israelis can react to all? Thing is going to depend, is going to determine the direction of this conflict. Are we going to de-escalate, or are we going to explore yet new territories of escalation that could indeed lead to that regional war?
All right, good stuff. Thank you, Dr. Ramzi Baroud, for joining us for this rolling coverage. Stay safe. Pleasure to have you on from Seattle, Washington. That was Dr. Baroud, author and a journalist. We saw Paul Lurudi for the Free Palestine Movement joining us from Northern California. Paul, if you would just allow me really quick to update our viewers that are with us or just joining us. We're in the middle of rolling coverage here on Press TV and a much-anticipated response to Israel's regional aggression. Iran last night attacked Tel Aviv with hundreds of ballistic missiles, with reports putting the barrage at over 400 missiles fired. According to the Israeli entity, they have put the number at 180 missiles fired into Tel Aviv, but saying that a large number were intercepted, a claim refuted by images. You can search them. They're all over social media spaces and on various media outlets have images of missiles, ballistic missiles, dozens upon dozens raining down on the night skyline of Tel Aviv, and barely any, for that matter, getting intercepted. Which basically is supported by the IRGC's claim that about 10%, in fact, of the missiles were intercepted. The IRGC said attack was aimed at three military bases in the area of Tel Aviv, one of which, the assassination of late Hezbollah leader Seyed Hassan Nasrallah, who was launched from, said the barrage was also accompanied by a large-scale cyber attack, and that Iran also utilized the new Fatah hypersonic ballistic missiles for a first time. Now, how many of those hundreds of missiles, these ballistic missiles, were in fact hypersonic, of the hypersonic nature at this point, we do not know, but I'm sure the news with respect to all the different dimensions of this retaliatory operation will come to light in the hours that ensue. Joining us now is Paul Lurudi from Northern California. Paul, is all the opportunities the regime had to de-escalate. Supposedly, Joe Biden wanted to see a ceasefire in Gaza, didn't want to see civilians disproportionately slaughtered over last year. Supposedly, didn't want to see the southern city of Rafah attacked, didn't want to see Israeli occupation boots on the ground, didn't want to see an escalation into Lebanon, didn't want to see Israeli boots on Lebanese soil. And did not want to see a lot of things that we have seen in the last year. Is all of this proof that the Israeli leader, Benjamin Netanyahu, is out of control, or is it all theatrics with respect to the elections, the presidential race coming up in your neck of the woods, and face that Biden has to show that he cares about? A lot of people, all he cares about is the election and Kamala Harris winning, not about the women and children of Gaza and not about the women and children of Lebanon.
Well, I don't know of anyone in that position of power in the U.S. government or the Israeli government that cares about human life, not even the life of their own citizens. But the only thing they care about is the reaction. And the reaction in terms of the election, of course, is paramount in the United States right now. The difficulty, I think at this point, the direction in which events will transpire will depend a great deal upon the effect on the election prospects for the Democrats, as well as whether Netanyahu can leverage the ability to draw the United States into the fight. And that's what he's looking for, because without bringing the United States in to create victory out of defeat, he's lost. So the question is, will the United States go so far as to commit its military to an extent that it will find itself in a quagmire in the Middle East, West Asia? And that's an unknown at this point. Will it help the Democrats to win the election? That's also an unknown at this point. Personally, I don't think even with the help of the United States that the forces of Iran and Ansar Allah and Hashd al-Shaabi and Kata'ib Hezbollah and Hezbollah and all of the Palestinian factions, especially Hamas, I can't imagine that they're going to go away. They will take any amount of punishment, of casualties and so forth, but they're going to remain there. I can't say the same for Israel.
And you know, some Western leaders and respective media out there in your neck of the woods, they're going to give this attack certain dimensions and characteristics. Paul, we call it a retaliatory attack by Iran. Nevertheless, they're going to call it provocative, escalatory. They're going to call it basically an aggression, what we've been calling Israel's attacks on its neighbors over the last year or so, not to mention a campaign of outright genocide against Gazans, leaving nearly 42,000 dead, 96 or 97,000 injured, thousands missing, presumed buried under a rubble. But you know how this last night's attack is going to get characterized by Western leaders. Do you feel Iran's missile attack last night was offensive or defensive in nature, Paul? And if you could give us a justification, whatever answer you choose.
I would say that it's a bit of both, but given the patience that Iran has shown until now, I would have to say that it is more of a defensive action, if you're familiar with if your audience is familiar with the conflict in Ukraine, the war in Ukraine, what happened there, Russia entered Ukraine only when it had no other choice but to do that. And in fact, they had to, CIA had to instruct Ukraine to increase the daily casualties against the Russian population of Ukraine from a few dozen up to 400 or even 500, 600 per day in order to push Russia to enter. Would we call it aggressive? Western press calls it aggressive. But really, Russia was forced into this this situation, and they tried, as you know, a month after they entered Ukraine to negotiate an end to the conflict, and they almost succeeded. So I find that Iran is in a similar situation here. They're being forced to enter the conflict, and that's true of other actors in the region. Like Hezbollah and Ansarullah and the others, but especially okay. Iran has to do this.
Thank you, Paul. Stay safe. Always a pleasure to check in with you, Mr. Paul Lurudi, there from the Free Palestine Movement, joining us from Berkeley, California. And viewers, at least we've been in the middle of rolling coverage all night. Iran has fired dozens of ballistic missiles last night, Tuesday evening in West Asia, at key military and security targets in Israel, namely against Tel Aviv in response to deadly attacks on Gaza and Lebanon, as well as the martyrdom of senior Hezbollah, Hamas, and IRGC leaders. Israel says large number of those missiles were intercepted, a claim refuted by images you could search anywhere online and media outlets to attain and see how many of those missiles you see hitting targets in Tel Aviv. Israeli officials have vowed a response, but time and again, multiple Iranian officials said that the regime will face a crushing response if it attacks Iran. And we're following developments very closely here on Press TV. We're going to leave you for a short bit and be back to continue our rolling coverage in about half an hour. Stay tuned, everyone, and goodbye for now.
£82,000 of American bombs exploded in Beirut while they were seeking to destroy a mountain. And the shot was heard all over the world. The clocks stopped, the tears fell, the mourning began, but the guns kept on blazing. Both the American guns in the hands of Netanyahu's Air Force and the guns of the resistance. Indeed, there has not been a moment's peace for the people of Lebanon or for the people of Netanyahu's settler state ever since the assassination of Syed Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, the leading force in the Lebanese resistance. Syed Hassan was no ordinary leader. Maybe once in 100 years or more, such a leader will come along. He transformed the Lebanese resistance from a few young men with Kalashnikovs to an army of 100,000 men, complete with all the aerial ordnance that would be required to make life unlivable for the whole population of the settler state. And if, as is widely trailed, Netanyahu intends a repeat of 2006 and a ground invasion of the sacred soil of the Lebanon, he's going to find out that Hezbollah has fighters on the ground just as proficient as the fighters in the air. The Lebanese population, as always, just as the population in the Gaza Strip, women, children, men who are not combatants, are being slain in massive numbers. In fact, day for day, the slaughter of the Lebanese civilians, of all kinds, by the way, Shiites, Sunnis, Christians, including towns, villages where Jesus walked, are extraordinarily high, and the killing fields have moved from Gaza through the West Bank into Lebanon. And the Jerusalem Post gave the game away. They've deleted it now, but for 3 days, the story was there on the portals of the Jerusalem Post. Apparently, God promised Lebanon to the Israelis, just as he had promised Palestine. That was removed because it rather gives the game away. The project of a greater Israel, beloved of the Likudniks, the two blue lines on the flag of what they call Israel, constitute from the River Nile to the River Euphrates, and now it turns out they want at least part of Lebanon as well. This kind of acquisition of other people's territory by force is, of course, a crime under international law, but it's a crime the Israelis have been getting away with for more than 75 years. And the so-called institutions of the so-called international community have turned out to be nothing but eunuchs. I've been studying the European Union, the United States, Great Britain, and the so-called international community, who represent, in fact, 13% of all humanity. The people of Lebanon have come together. In the past, that was not always so. But Christian figures like General Aoun, like Suleiman Frangieh, like even the formerly phalangist Catholic Christian Lebanese parties, have said that if a hair is harmed on the head of any Lebanese, that the Lebanese people will come together as one to defend them. And the national unit which has broken out in Lebanon is the first and best answer to Netanyahu's fiendish plans. The resistance will go on. Everybody loses their father, and it's painful. But their father is still with them. His memories, his ideas, his inspiration, his teachings, his line will continue. And so it will be true of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. He was no ordinary leader, but he was a man, and all men must pass. God is the real leader of the Hezbollah and other organizations in other parts of the axis of resistance. They believe that they are doing God's work. They believe that they are holy warriors, and they will not be dissuaded from the path to liberate Jerusalem by the heavy blows which Hezbollah undoubtedly suffered over the last few days. Those heavy blows have, they say, decapitated the Hezbollah. But I think they're about to find out different. They ain't seen nothing yet. After the Nasrallah assassination, what's next? You've come to the right place. Have it out with Galloway to find out. Syed Hussein Maki holds a BA in journalism and an MA in religions and global politics. He's been a student of the Islamic sciences since 2012 at the seminary in Lebanon, and he joins us now. Said Hussein, thanks for joining us. Very heavy blows have been absorbed by the Lebanese people, by the Lebanese resistance, but the struggle continues, does it not?
Thank you for having me, George. And yes, of course, the struggle does continue. And for the place in which the Lebanese people come from, especially the ethos of the Lebanese resistance, they are not a people that are easily defeated. They understand their heritage, most of all, their heritage that comes from their belief in Imam al-Hussein. Imam al-Hussein is the third Shi'i Imam, and he is the inspiration which created Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah. And that is still alive. Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah is an individual, an amazing individual, but that light remains shining bright. And so everyone looks towards the lessons they have from Imam al-Hussein, which are, when one is posed between two choices, he has to face death or humiliation, he will always go towards death first, because we say, hayhat minna dhilla. We do not accept humiliation. So all these people in Lebanon right now, although these are heavy blows, they understand that from 2006 and from 2000 and from before that, they have experienced this before. This doesn't mean that the war is over. More destruction and more killing does not mean that Israel is winning. Actually, they haven't accomplished any of their goals so far in 12 months, neither in Gaza or in Lebanon.
The war in Gaza now, as you rightly say, almost 1 year on, and even this day, a resistance strike near Khan Yunis took many Israeli casualties. The struggle of the Israeli armed forces in Gaza does not portend an easy time for them were they to go ahead with a ground invasion of Lebanon, does it?
No. You see, the Israeli military relies a lot on its technology. When it comes to their individuals, these people, they like comfort. The way that they are defeated is when you actually have to face them man to man. These people do not wish to sacrifice their lives for anything. They want this world. And they are up against people who believe in the afterlife, just like we believe that we're talking to each other right now. And they know they're on the side of truth. I think the whole world, this is even about Islam. This is humanity. The whole world knows that the side of justice is to be against the killers of children who have killed over 40,000 people in Palestine up till now, and in the last week have killed over 1,600 Lebanese, injuring 8,000 Lebanese, and displacing 1 million Lebanese. For what? For what?
The bombs which killed Sayyid Hassan and his noble bodyguards, and indeed a visitor from the Iranian IRGC, were American bombs. The airplanes which fired them were American airplanes. It's impossible to believe, as Biden Harris seek to fool us into believing, that the Americans were not involved in this murder. The order was given from the city of New York, and given from the building of the United Nations, no less. This is an American-Israeli attack on Lebanon, is it not?
If there's one thing that Sayyid Hassan taught his people and his followers, it's that Israel receives everything from America. America ultimately is the big boss. It's not complicit in the genocide of the Palestinians, and it's not complicit in what's happening in America, in Lebanon, Afwan. It is a direct actor. Actually, they just gave an approved $8.7 billion worth of weaponry to Israel, and those 85 Buster bunker bombs weighing 2,000 to 4,000 pounds each were from America, made in America. Killing, by the way, killing hundreds of civilians, leveling 6 buildings. At the same time, and when Harris or Biden released their statement, they don't have one word of condemnation against the killing of children, even though it is so similar to what happened in 9/11, destroying towers with civilians in it, which, by the way, the man they call a terrorist, Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah, condemned. He condemned the tactics of bin Laden. He fought against Al-Qaeda in Syria. He fought against ISIS in Syria. He condemned what happened on 9/11. This very same man that they call a terrorist because they want him to be a terrorist is a man that was the only one standing up to the Israeli powers as he tried to implement what the UN resolutions were calling for anyway, and what most of the international community was calling for anyway. He was the only one that was actually willing to go all the way, though. And the Israeli officials have said this. They admitted that the reason they decided to kill him was because he would not take a side deal without the Palestinians. Any ceasefire deal for Lebanon, he said, has to involve Gaza. They admit this. So they're not killing a terrorist. They're killing the man who wanted peace. They're killing the man who wanted the UN resolutions to stand. He just had the teeth for it. He was the one who tried to implement that. And they won't say the true narrative. They'll constantly try to label him as the terrorist. People have been calling for this ceasefire all year in Gaza. Hundreds and thousands of people have marched, millions of people all around the world. And now we're still in the same place talking about the same thing happening in another country. So if we're going to rely on the powers that be, we're going to see a lot of people get genocided. There had to be someone who is willing to stand up to them, and now he gave his blood for it.
The will and testament of Syed Hassan has now been published. In it, he asked the faithful people to repose their trust and their faith in Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. Will that entirely observed by the people, or is there a case for saying that if Iran had responded, as they said they would, to the murder of Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran, then Syed Hassan might still be alive, because Israel would have known what they were potentially up against? You must be aware of that line of thinking out there in the amongst the people.
Yes, of course. Of course I am. First of all, I respect the intelligence of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the same intelligence which impressed legendary intellectuals like Noam Chomsky and Edward Said when they met him, as is written in their memoirs. I respect his intelligence. He's not a sheep. And he understood the idea of the resistance axis more than anyone. And he understood the role of Lebanon as the neighboring country to Israel and the differing role that it has to Iran. But there would be no, I wouldn't say no resistance, but the power of the resistance would be very different of the whole region if it wasn't for Iran and all that Iran sacrificed and all that Iran has had to endure in terms of sanctions because of its support of the oppressed and those who resist. Now, when it comes to Sayyid Khamenei, that's a whole different issue because that's beyond Iran. Now we're talking about something where religion is involved, not only politics, and where Sayyid Hassan was always, it was no secret, he was very loyal to Sayyid Khamenei. And the ones who follow Sayyid Hassan, they don't follow a normal leader. And George, you know this, most of the world probably don't know this. Sayyid Hassan was not a normal leader. He's not a leader in it for himself. This man didn't enjoy anything from this world. This man gave his son for what he believed in. This man couldn't see the sun itself for many weeks and months. No one knew where he was. This man barely made any money. He was not in it for himself. He was in it because he truly believed in the path of God. He believed to, he had to stand up against injustice and he had to sacrifice everything in his way. And he saw himself, and he constantly said this, when he was named Man of the Year about 15 years ago, when he was in Iran, he made sure to kiss the hand of Sayyid Khamenei in front of everyone because he said, you name me Man of the Year, but I wanted to show that I am a loyal soldier of Sayyid Khamenei. He believes in this path of Wilayatul Faqih. And so those who have been raised by Sayyid Hassan, that's why he's not a normal leader. He raised people. He grew up in front of them and they grew up with him. And they went to war together. These people, they are going to be loyal to the 30 or 40 years of education that he has given them that's still there, that people need to study and realize why it was that he taught them. I believe that, yes, his loyal followers will be loyal to Sayyid Khamenei because they never differentiated between the both of them. This was beyond being Lebanese or Iranian or Yemeni or Iraqi. This was about going towards what is right. And that's why you'll find in Lebanon women who are Christian, men who are Sunni, Druze, whoever it is, they are all weeping for the martyrdom of Sayyid Hassan. Of course, there are always going to be people that are talking about him being someone that they don't like or whatever he did, or sectarianism. These are all Zionist talking points for sectarianism or trying to dissolve the unity between the factions which are against the colonial and imperial powers. This is the easiest and oldest trick in the book.
The awesome silence of the Arab states has never been more starkly displayed than this. Most of them have not even condemned the Israeli attack, the assassination, the slaughter of many hundreds of Lebanese people of all sects and faiths, as you say. Lebanon is a member of the Arab League. Who knew the Arabs had a league? It's a fourth division conference league, if you remember your football from your time in London. But what can we expect from the Arab masses who, from Marrakesh to Bahrain, overwhelmingly feel the same way as you do, as I do, about the crimes of Netanyahu?
Ultimately, George, unfortunately, I don't believe that the Arab states will make much of a difference. Just like in the last year, we've seen they haven't made much of a difference. It's very sad that we're still here, actually. I remember all the talking shows that I was watching about a year ago, right in the beginning of the genocide in Gaza, and the talking points are still the same now. It's just happening in Lebanon. I don't think the Arab states are going to have much of an effect, because at the end of the day, they paddle around for what America wants and what Israel wants. They're not going to stand in their way. The only ones willing to hold them accountable are ones who are actually prepared to defend themselves, even if it requires force, which is a natural conclusion that any people would make. They would defend themselves. Just like everyone says, Israel apparently has a right to defend itself, even though 82% of the attacks between Lebanon and Israel in the last year, since October 7th, has come from Israel. Even though, since 2007, Israel has broken 35,000 times the UN resolution of 1701. So Israel is doing all of this, and they haven't stopped it in the last 15, 20, 30 years, and they won't do anything about it now. The only way I believe we can help these people, of course, it needs pressure as much as we can from the outside, but ultimately it's going to rely on the indigenous people to protect and defend themselves and exhaust the Zionist entity until it realizes that it's self-destructing. And that's what it's doing right now. More killing and more destruction does not mean it's winning. To win a war is to achieve objectives of war, and they haven't been able to achieve any of these objectives of war.
Now, the shoe that has not dropped is the Iranian shoe. When it drops, if it drops, it will be with a heavy thud. Do you still expect that shoe to drop? Do you expect it to be a significant game-changing moment? Or do you think that the current stasis will continue vis-a-vis the now serial crimes that Israel has committed against Iran? The assassination of Haniya, the wounding of the Iranian ambassador in Lebanon, the killing of the IRGC deputy commander. I mean, Iran now has a lot of entirely lawful reasons for retaliation. Are they going to take that offer?
First of all, like I said, I respect the intelligence of Sayyid Hassan. I also respect the intelligence of Sayyid Khamenei. But because of this, I would say that to do so, to interfere right now, would be to suggest that the Lebanese resistance is on its final legs, which it isn't yet, which it just needs to readjust because of the damages that it has suffered in the last 2 weeks. But there's still a lot for it to give. Now, the war against Israel is mainly a war of attrition. It is in the benefit of those who resist Israel for the war to carry on longer, because that's how you defeat a superpower that is the most well-armed power and with the most intelligence perhaps in history. Israel prefers to finish things quickly and make decisive blows, but that's why it is never able to achieve its objectives. Right now, okay, you killed the faces of the resistance in Lebanon, but there's still all the masses that you don't know who they are, you don't know their faces, and they all want revenge. So this is going to be a very long war. And it is in the benefit of those who wish to see Israel lose for the war to carry on in a way that Israel